So we are here today to talk about Dr. Rosalind Coffey's book, The British Press, Public Opinion and the End of Empire in Africa, The Wind of Change, 1957 to 1960, which was published in 2022. We're a bit behind, but we're catching up and we're here to celebrate that today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce our speakers. So Dr. Coffey is going to speak about the book, and then we're going to have commentary from two experts in the field about the book as well. So let me introduce them first, and then I can hand over to Dr. Coffey to tell us more about the book as well. So Dr. Rosalind Coffey is a guest teacher in our department, the Department of International History. Her research examines the links between British newspaper coverage in Africa, public opinion, politics, and culture. She has been teaching in our department for many years on world history during the 20th century. She also held a senior teaching fellowship in African history at SOAS. I should also say she's won at least 4 teaching awards in the university. She's one of our most celebrated teachers, particularly of our undergraduate world history courses. So I just wanted to underline how grateful we are to you for that, and also to say that this has been accomplished alongside that teaching. Okay, commenting on the book, we will start with Professor Sarah Stockwell, who is joining us from the Department of History at King's College. Professor Sarah Stockwell is Professor of History of Empire and Decolonisation at King's College London. She's a specialist in 20th century British colonial and African history, and she has written extensively on the British Empire, including the impact of imperialism on Britain, publishing several works which examine how different groups and institutions within Britain engage with the process of British decolonisation. And we'll then turn to Professor Stephen Casey from our own department, the Department of International History, who will be speaking on the book. And he is a specialist, as many of you know, on US foreign policy, who's written extensively on the US American media and public opinion during the 20th century, including the 2 world wars and the Cold War. So without further ado, let me hand over to Dr. Coffey to introduce her book. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tanya. Can you hear me okay? Not so much. Okay. How about this? A bit better? Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Please let me know if you can't hear me at the back. Thank you so much for the introduction, Tanya. Really appreciate that. I wanted to begin with some thank yous in general. Thank you everyone for coming here today. I've got some friendly faces from various places in my life. It's wonderful, wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you very much to Dr. Tanya Harmer, Professor Sarah Stockwell, and Professor Steve Casey for talking at this event. I feel really honoured that you would be a part of it. Thank you very much. Thank you too to Dr. Anna Kant and Max Smith for organising the event, as well as to the members of the Modern World History Research Cluster in the Department of International History, as well as to Professor Mark Baer, the department head, for supporting the event. I'm grateful to my PhD supervisor, Joanna Lewis, as well, and my second supervisor, Professor Taylor Sherman, and Anthony Best, who is here too, Professor Anthony Best. I do want to tell you that I'm going to be projecting some images, photos, and cartoons during the presentation, some of which contain some racist imagery. Just a little bit of a content warning on that. It's the image that you see on the front cover of my book kind of exemplifies many of the contradictions, actually, or apparent contradictions that existed in newspaper coverage of this period. And that included racist imagery alongside narratives which appeared comparatively progressive, really, in respect of the strength, significance, and even moral weight of African nationalism during this period. So So what role did British newspaper coverage play in the process of decolonization in Africa? This was my research question. No one had conducted an in-depth study of the subject, although there were some smaller case studies. Broadly, I wanted to know whether the newspaper coverage was significant, and if so, in what ways and for whom. My research focused on a pivotal moment in the history of Africa when processes of decolonization gained pace. I examined 10 British newspapers concerning events in Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, South Africa, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The newspapers were the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, the Daily Herald, the Daily Mirror, the News Chronicle, the Daily Telegraph, the Times, the Manchester Guardian, the Observer, and to some extent, the Daily Sketch. At the height of some events, it wouldn't have been unusual to find 10 articles about them per day in many of these newspapers, so there was a lot of coverage. I analysed press content alongside its production and reception to arrive at conclusions regarding its role. I examined African and white settler newspapers too, government documents in Britain and Africa, newspaper archives, the personal papers of journalists, politicians, and other individuals and groups that interacted with the press, and autobiographies and memoirs. I also conducted some interviews with journalists to whom I'm very grateful. William Kirkman, who worked for the Times, Stanley Ace, who was a stringer for the News Chronicle, it's a South African, and Derek Ingram, the deputy editor of the Daily Mail. I also corresponded with another South African, Peter Younghusband, who was a stringer for the Daily Mail, to whom I also extend my gratitude. My findings indicate that British newspapers affected decolonization not only inside Britain, where I've identified some new dynamics, but also in Africa, a part of the process which existing studies of the press tended to neglect, choosing to examine what British newspapers could tell us about British opinion and British policy making. So this is a brief. So this is the broad structure of what I'll be talking about today, and that reflects those three areas of focus. British newspapers and news of British press coverage traveled to Africa. British newspapers were sold in Africa. African and white settler papers also reprinted and responded to British newspaper articles. Notwithstanding the fact that the British coverage was affected by a range of influences, including from inside Britain, African nationalists, activists, white settlers, and politicians in Africa more broadly all engaged the British press during the wind of change. British newspapers provided a means by which African nationalists and some Europeans living in Africa who were supportive of political reform contested colonial rule or aspects of it, and opposition parties following independence confronted governments with whom they disagreed, for example. The Malawi Youth League, for instance, exploited the presence of British journalists in Nyasaland during the Prime Minister Harold Macmillan's 1960 Commonwealth Tour of Africa, subsequently dubbed the Wind of Change Tour, to amplify their calls for freedom. Thandeka Makandawiri, a Malawi Youth League activist and subsequently LSE professor, who participated in a large demonstration outside a hotel in Blantyre where Macmillan was having lunch on the tour, later explained that the Malawi Youth League had, quote, wanted the gentlemen of the press to tell the world about them. The demonstration, in which calls for independence were made, as well as strong opposition expressed to the white settler-dominated Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, a political entity that most Africans in the region despised, attracted substantial publicity, whose tenor prompted an inquiry. There were about 400 Malawi Youth League activists present that day, although the total crowd was 800 to 1,000 strong. African protest against the Federation had occurred earlier on in the tour as well, capturing press attention. When Macmillan was in Nigeria, for example, he had visited the University of Ibadan, where journalists reported the students' demonstration in which the protesters waved placards emblazoned with slogans including "Lord Mulvern is an ass, tell him so." And Lord Mulvern was one of the architects of the Federation. British public opinion, with which the press was understood to be connected, was considered particularly significant in the case of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, because the British Parliament had the power to vote on the future of the Federation. I found evidence during my research that in this period, pressure from British newspapers on issues concerning Central Africa, including the Federation, helped actively to set the British government's agenda toward it in ways that resulted in increasingly favorable outcomes for Africans, affecting the calling of the Devlin inquiry, for example, into the circumstances surrounding a declaration of a state of emergency the previous year, and the Monckton Commission to travel to Central Africa to gauge opinion about the Federation, as well as British government decision-making surrounding the release of Hastings Banda, the leader of the Malawi Congress Party, Nyasaland's foremost political party, from detention in 1960. So this speaks to the significance of the press, but African nationalist efforts at engaging British editors and journalists during the 50s and 60s, of which these demonstrations were examples, in addition to the broader campaigns of Africans to challenge European colonialism, and which invariably attracted press coverage, must be considered as a root cause of these developments. Some papers, like The Observer, came to champion the work of nationalists, resulting in some close partnerships whose influence cut both ways. From the mid-50s in Ghana, the main opposition party, the National Liberation Movement, cultivated relations with the British right-leaning press as part of a bid to confront the ruling Convention People's Party, led by Kwame Nkrumah, the Gold Coast's, so the name for Ghana during the colonial period, the Gold Coast's first elected leader during a period of co-government with the British throughout the 50s, and from 1957, its first prime minister. The NLM's relationship with British right-leaning papers became quite tight. It suited these papers well too, because they had for years generally advocated for empire and establishment interests, and were in opposition to socialism, with which Nkrumah was aligned. In other words, they needed little encouragement. Ever since the NLM's formation in 1954, following the ruling party, the CCP's second electoral victory that year, and therefore lacking a parliamentary presence, the NLM had turned to vociferous public criticism of Nkrumah's government, as well as to extra-parliamentary activity, including a propaganda campaign in London to air and advance their case. According to the historian Richard Rathbone, the NLM campaign sought to portray the CPP as despotic and was supported by elements in London who were either apprehensive about the dissolution of the colonial empire in general or about the imminence of the Gold Coast independence in particular. An example of an action which symbolised the NLM's efforts to engage British newspapers came in 1957, the year in which Ghana became independent, when the Daily Mail reported that its correspondent had been, quote, summoned to an urgent meeting in Kumasi, the capital of Ashanti and the heartland of the NLM, by Sir Agyeman Prempeh, quote, ruler of the Ashanti nation. The meeting concerned efforts the NLM had made before Independence Day to ensure that regional safeguards were embedded in the constitution. This was considered important in Ghana, as well as in many other African countries,
because post-colonial states whose borders had been drawn by Europeans, often arbitrarily, encompassed multiple ethnic groups. Colonial rule and the process of decolonization itself had also created new cleavages in societies at the same time as solidifying pre-existing ones. And there were, of course, also pre-existing ones that operated independently, as in any society. The newspaper reported that Ashanti elders had reached out to Alan Lennox Boyd, the British colonial secretary, at one point without success. "We have heard only silence," the paper reported Prempeh as saying. "It is possible that Mr. Lennox Boyd has not heard. Thinking that may be possible, it is my hope that a message through the Daily Mail will help us by explaining our worries to the British people. Through you, I want to speak to the British people as an old and good friend." The NLM's efforts to engage British newspapers in this, as well as in subsequent communications, represented an important factor which lay behind the press's increasingly critical coverage of the CPP during 1957. The CPP engaged in a process of nation building, worried that the British articles, both informed by opposition groups in Ghana and then reproduced by opposition newspapers in Ghana, were helping to foment division within the country. The CPP was also mindful at this point of the importance of maintaining a good image overseas in order to attract the foreign investment necessary for development. In addition, in South Africa at the time of the Sharpeville massacre, some members of the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and the South African Liberal Party, as well as journalists from South Africa who were also often members of a political party, took active steps to influence British press treatment of the country under apartheid, a system they fought. British newspaper coverage also informed wider political and civic practices in Africa. Groups in tight corners deployed it to nurture cultures of belonging, exclusion, and blame. In the white settler communities of Central and South Africa, for example, I argue that British newspaper articles informed narratives of self and community. South Africa is a particularly interesting case, I think, owing to the nature of the relationship between British newspapers and the South African English language press, which had, by the wind of change, been closely connected for decades. When, in 1960, the British press published critical material on apartheid, and this appeared in the Daily Mail, some of which was produced by South African stringers employed by South African English language papers, the action provided a pretext for the South African government's expression of more latent thoughts and fears that cut to the very heart of white society. For the ruling National Party, it seemed to confirm the presence of an enemy within, which connected to the history of white settlement in the region and which centered on the presence of both Afrikaans and English-speaking communities. Peter Younghusband, who wrote this article, actually, I think, one of them, the journalist I corresponded with, recalled that in Parliament in 1960, quote, "a few of us sitting in the press gallery were pointed at by Lowe, Eric Lowe, South Africa's Minister of Foreign Affairs, who said, quote, 'There they sit, Mr. Speaker, so-called South Africans who would sell the good name of their country for 30 pieces of silver.'" Younghusband was an Afrikaner, but worked for the South African English language press at the same time as stringing for the British Daily Mail. Another South African minister claimed that British newspapers, meaning South African English language papers, were still fighting the Anglo-Boer War. "They have never forgotten," this is a quote, "that these despicable Boers succeeded in taking over the reins of government in South Africa." Because of where these sorts of articles appeared in the British press and the ways in which they were produced by South African stringers, often English-speaking, but not always, they were understood as constituting part and parcel of the longer-running inter-white conflict for political power in South Africa. Perceiving journalists, particularly white ones, as a main source of their woes was, moreover, a means by which some settlers were able to disaggregate from their cultures more discomforting issues, including African opposition to white minority rule, colonial brutality, which formed the focus of many of the press reports at this time, and the importance of political reform. In Ghana, British newspaper coverage performed a similar role. There, it also served as a reference point or an enemy against whose actions the culture of the ruling party could consolidate. During 1957, and despite the anxieties it provoked, British newspaper coverage of Ghana seems to have provided a means by which the CPP aimed to cement its domestic political popularity. During 1957, local papers in Ghana, including the ruling party's own paper, the Ghana Evening News, as well as the opposition paper, the Ashanti Times, reproduced or commented on British articles or sections of them, sometimes frequently. In the Gold Coast, African politicians, intellectuals, and activists had long harnessed the press to their political causes, including the fight for independence, which involved the consolidation of a new nationalism. In doing so, they drew on a long tradition of print journalism in the region. In the summer of 1957, faced by an onslaught of negative British press coverage, the Ghana Evening News took the, quote, capitalist imperialist press, mostly the Telegraph and Express, but at this point it included quite a lot of the press, to task for its reporting of the country following independence in an editorial entitled British Press Goes Mad, a piece that was subsequently reprinted, apparently at popular request. This decision, amongst similar ones, reinforced the CPP's position as the dominant anti-colonial party in Ghana, at the same time as reminding newspaper readers that European colonialism, as manifested in the press and elsewhere, remained an ever-present threat to the nation, a conviction that gained credence from the history of Ghana's own white press in buttressing British imperial interests in previous years. I couldn't find British Press Goes Mad for this presentation. I was looking for it in my file, and I've come across some articles from 1961, so it's a slightly different context, but that I guess allude to some similar themes. These articles are from the Ghana Evening News, and I found them in a British government file. Similar themes: foreign press conspiracy, a reference to double standard, the sort of resurrection of colonialism, neo-colonialism in Ghana, and then another article in which British journalists are referred to as hypocrites, murderers, and nitwits as well. So, yeah, strong feelings against the British press. In these places, then, British newspapers affected the lived experiences of the end of empire of influential African and white settler groupings, providing a prism through which they consolidated their understanding not only of Britain, but also of their own community's place in the world. In the book, I emphasize what I refer to as the passive utility of press coverage. British press coverage didn't only have an impact owing to how it was projected out into the world, but was significant also owing to the ways in which it was understood and used by readerships. In Britain, the coverage influenced the government, notwithstanding the impact of the government on the press in respect of Kenya, which was at war for much of the 50s. British newspaper coverage affected British policy toward the Federation, as I mentioned earlier, goading the government in the direction of African nationalism. It shaped the government's declarations on apartheid. During Macmillan's 1960 Commonwealth tour, Macmillan experienced pressure from British journalists, as well as African nationalists, and sometimes jointly, strongly to criticise apartheid. Just prior to the tour, and as an example of this collaboration, The Observer had published an open letter from Albert Luthuli, the president of the ANC, alongside three others, which implored Macmillan on his visit to the Union, quote, not to say one single word that could be construed to be in praise of apartheid. Internal government documents suggest that the words the Prime Minister uttered in Cape Town in 1960, when he declared that the wind of change is blowing through this continent, reflected a desire to appease these groups. Perhaps more than this, however, and certainly in the case of the Cape Town speech, British newspapers also informed British policy outcomes indirectly by presenting alternative British views in Africa, which competed with the government's diplomatic overtures on post-colonial Africa and settler societies, undermining Commonwealth solidarity on a popular level and fostering tension. The British government regarded the Commonwealth as the natural successor to the empire and a means by which Britain might preserve its global influence. The government aimed to conserve good relations with all of the groups it hoped to keep within the Commonwealth fold and engaged in a delicate rhetorical juggling act in speeches and other communications that was designed to appeal equally, even to people vehemently opposed to one another. British newspapers inhibited the government's ability to monopolize the British narrative that circulated in Africa. British newspapers claimed to speak on behalf of the British public, or were perceived to, and overseas readerships took note. Following the Wind of Change speech, for example, the South African government appeared more concerned with journalists' interpretations of Macmillan's words than with the speech's content. The speech was actually quite measured in its support for Africans. However, the British press hailed the speech a milestone in its support for Africans, which concerned many in the National Party in South Africa, as well as, interestingly, Macmillan and his advisers. The dynamic was also evident at other moments during the tour. When Macmillan was in Central Africa, for example, British newspapers reported a speech that Macmillan delivered in which he discussed the Federation. Upon reviewing the speech, white settlers seemed quite calm about the wording, but this did not allay the settlers' fears surrounding the importance of British press reporting of the speech, and which signified the Federation's future demise. As I mentioned earlier, British public opinion was considered particularly important in the case of the Federation. The settlers' fears were that British newspapers were providing insight into the real character of British opinion on Central Africa, and/or that they were moulding British opinion in ways that were detrimental to the settlers' political survival, irrespective of what British politicians told them was true. So concerning Britain, the coverage impacted policy. It may also have informed British public attitudes. One of the main concerns in the historical literature on the British cultural dimension to decolonization in Africa and elsewhere centers on whether ordinary people felt a sense of national decline at this time of waning global influence and violence. How did decolonization impact the ways that British people thought about Britain? Historians have looked at a wealth of cultural resources to engage with this question. With this issue in mind, I argue in the book that British press coverage tended not to convey sentiments that reinforced a sense of weakness, failure, or loss. Instead, I suggest the coverage performed a rather affirming function for Britain. The press tended to cast Britain's involvement in Africa in a positive light, and the new era of decolonization as an organic development, whose wave it was auspicious to ride, but for which the question of decline was not relevant. Representations of African nationalism, an article about, a march involving 30,000 people shortly after the Sharpeville massacre, that related to protests surrounding the imprisonment of leaders. But it's interesting, I think, that this is not the sort of image we associate, is it, even with the Sharpeville massacre. This is an example of the fact that African nationalism shines through the coverage, and even at the moments where you might expect the focus to be on something like colonial brutality, or in this case as well, really, I guess, the theme of kind of African victimhood in a sense. I think talking about the Sharpeville massacre, this is a very different portrayal, and it comes through the coverage all of the time. representations of African nationalism action, power and violence, and of the increasing inevitability of decolonization and the unfeasibility of empire featured the most prominently in the coverage. But the reasons which lay behind the activism tended not to be communicated in any great depth. Certainly, no historical depth, I would say. Instead, African nationalism often appeared as a natural feature of what was referred to as a changing world, changing times, or not the 19th century anymore. In cartoons, the use of imagery from the natural world to portray nationalism further reinforced the sentiment, I think. Presenting nationalism as an organic or amorphous thing, like wave or wind, I think would not have prompted much critical introspection on the dark side of empire. You know, what was the cause here? I think this is largely omitted from newspaper coverage of this period. Additionally, while acknowledging by the late 50s that decolonization would occur, most British journalists discussed the events of these years in terms of accruals, which included beginnings, the formation and onward march of nations and nationalism, independence and the bestowing of freedom, rather than finalities, metropolitan decline or the end of empire. Alongside this, the press also tended to present Britain's role in Africa positively, notwithstanding the criticisms that appeared and then abated during 1959, expressed a supercilious attitude towards white settlers and Britain's colonial representatives in regions such as Central and South Africa, whom they portrayed as distant and alien, including in the context of discussions about colonial brutality, and depicted post-colonial Africa rather negatively, separating via their wording and imagery the challenges post-colonial states faced from the continent's history of European, including British, imperialism. These two articles on the right are taken from the time of the Congo crisis during 1960. And you can see, well, a major theme of newspaper coverage during this period is really its kind of present and forward-looking orientation, which often neglected the past, and I think links to that point about why it is that there's very little kind of explanation, at least deep historical explanation, given for the phenomena that were being covered in the newspapers and that perhaps didn't provide British readers, certainly, with the full information about what was done, essentially, in Britain's name on the African continent during colonial rule. There we are. I have finished.
Well, thank you very much. And actually, looking at your slides, I love the little bits you get on some of the images, like a little bit about Prince Philip going to the rescue in a soft hat and a Mac. Anyway, thank you very much, Rosie, for inviting me to participate and help celebrate the launch of the book. And I'd like to congratulate you on it. I think it's, you know, an excellent book. I really enjoyed reading it and I learned a great deal. And as you indicated, despite some excellent books on media and empire, there's been very little written about decolonisation in the British press. So on those grounds alone, Rosie's book would be a notable addition to the field. But she also shows through her conclusions why such a study is valuable. Through each of the case studies, she makes a convincing case that reporting mattered, and indeed that British papers were significant players within the decolonisation process. And as she's explained, her arguments here are threefold. First, that press reporting shaped perceptions at home of developments in Africa. And second, that a range of different actors and communities in Britain and Africa sought to enlist the press in support of their own agendas. Also the very interesting arguments about the passive role played by the press that Rose has also mentioned a few minutes ago. And actually, looking at the slide that you had, one of the slides you had, it was the Ghanaian press in 1961. I was sort of struck by another element to that, and thinking about my own research from Ghana on the 1950s, of how Nkrumah used the press then for a kind of performative anti-colonialism. It was a bit of a smokescreen for the associations that he had with British interests that his party were critiquing in the papers. And then thirdly, of course, you show that British reporting was consequential, particularly in Central and South Africa. And your arguments developed across the five chapters, and the chapters seem to me to work really nicely together. I liked, for instance, how the discussion of Macmillan's Cape Town Wind of Change speech in chapter three was followed by analysis of press reporting of the Sharpeville massacre. And that allowed you to demonstrate the limits to the progressivism of the press. With journalists, you argue, initially ambivalent and equivocal in their reporting of Sharpeville and divided over how Britain should respond to the atrocity. And similarly, the inclusion of the chapter on the Congo, I thought was very nice because it enabled you to contrast reporting of Anglophone African countries with that on a former Belgian one. And I thought, too, some particularly fine analysis about the context in which the press operated, including as to how British journalism was shaped by practical and business constraints as much as by ideological concerns. And across the five different chapters, I thought very interesting arguments about the journalists' frames of understanding, and for example, that they frequently lacked historical knowledge or other tools with which to interpret the events they were witnessing, and as you show most acutely in the case of the Congo. So I want to concentrate my comments on parts of your arguments, and I think, I'm going to say I think you provide ample evidence of the diverse ways in which the press was significant, and in support of the premise that the press didn't simply reflect society's views but helped constitute them. And I don't want to question any of the fundamentals of your conclusions, but just probe a little bit around the edges of some of them. And the first one is the claim that you make in several places that reporting, and I'm quoting Rosie here, spun a transnational web of influence over the decolonisation process. Now, while not disputing that the press played a key role, I nevertheless wonder if this claim doesn't attribute perhaps too much agency to the press, and by implication too little to those who sought to use it for their own ends, i.e. wasn't the press at all that different individuals and organisations which were already transnational in character, utilised in pursuit of their own agendas. And here I'm thinking, for example, of anti-colonial networks that incorporated African and British and other activists, or, as in the case of Ghana, those between British business interests and opposition politicians and others in Britain. And I also, in relation to these transnational networks, wondered about the traction of British press reporting in different African contexts relative to other transnational broadcasting media. So I was thinking about things like Radio Cairo, so how those sort of sit together perhaps in terms of the impact within African contexts. And whether it's also possible to say anything about non-British press reporting. So you note in several places that there were significant numbers of non-British journalists present. Indeed, I think you say from Macmillan's Cape Town speech, there were about 40 journalists there and only 10 of them were British. And I know this is asking for more information, and it's maybe unfair to give that kind of shopping list of things one wants to know more about, but I wondered if it's possible to say whether there are distinctions in coverage or not. On Macmillan's Africa tour, I thought this was a particularly fine chapter, but I wanted just to home in on that part of your argument that the press not only shaped the impact of the speech, I can absolutely see that, but that in doing so, they frustrated a more middle-of-the-road policy. And I say this, you know, having noted what you say was Macmillan's dismay that the press focused on that wind of change phrase. But it still seems to me that the press picked up on the bits of the speech that Macmillan intended to have impact. You know, when you listen to the speech, you hear him banging on the lectern and emphasising particular bits. And I wondered what the sort of middle of the road policy might have been. After all, as you note and as others have argued, it's pretty non-committal what he says, and it's ambivalent in places. So I'm thinking, you know, what is this middle of the road policy that's frustrated? And lastly, I wanted to turn to the point that despite the different agendas, politics and emphasis of right and left-leaning British papers, I think you bring those out really well, British reporting reinforced, as you discussed at the end, self-affirming structures of understanding in Britain on Africa, empire and decolonisation. Like a particular form of World War II nostalgia common to British culture, so too reporting of African decolonisation from this account bolstered distinct narratives about Britain's past with what, depending on our individual political perspectives, could be held to have long-term negative consequences. The press emphasis, as you've said just now, was on African activism rather than colonial action and violence. Now, it's a significant conclusion. But perhaps one that's not very surprising. And I'm going to say this with some trepidation because there are others here who know much more about the press than I do, but it does seem to me that nationally self-affirming narratives are the kind of stock in trade of the British press, with papers, depending on their different politics, likely to criticise and campaign against individuals, organisations and governments, but rarely in ways which kind of challenge the predominant values and ideologies of society. And equally, this self-affirmatory narrative, with its emphasis on activism, African activism, was, rather than imperial decline, was one which served the interests of African nationalists, i.e. the story of triumphant nationalism was one in which the outgoing imperial power and successor politicians had a common vested interest. But a question I have about this self-affirmatory narrative is whether within it some colonialisms are considered better than others, i.e. Does it posit ideas of British exceptionalism? Now, Belgium obviously figures in the book, and you have that comparative element, but the Congo crisis is quite sui generis. And I wonder whether you picked up on any discussion of the French Empire, for instance, i.e., as I say, you know, were some colonialisms presented in the British press as better than others, and is there a sort of sense of British exceptionalism here? I also wondered about the gendered nature of press reporting. I didn't pick up, but maybe I missed it, and I suspect there weren't any female journalists reporting on Africa.
One.
But I wondered how far, if the press pack was predominantly male, whether it contributed to the construction of African nationalism as patriarchal and male, i.e. was there any reporting of women's activism, African women's activism? And just on this subject of the press and the public, I thought it would be interesting to know a bit about reader responses, i.e. through the letter pages, i.e. did the Africa stories elicit particular correspondence? And then finally, in relation to the Ghanaian chapter, I wondered about negative reporting of post-colonial Africa, how that squared with big businesses' need to maintain investor confidence. You know, the alliance of big business, opposition, and a right-wing press goes back to the colonial period, when there was still a prospect that the constitutional arrangements for Ghana might be changed and that the British government would opt for federal system that would give autonomy to the relative autonomy to the Ashanti region within a federal system. But by the time we get to sort of the independence period, that prospect is gone. And therefore, maybe this alliance is at higher risk in terms of investor confidence in sort of undermining confidence in the regime. So I had a question about that, the link there. I'm going to end there, but just to say, just in conclusion, I thought, you know, as I say, it's a really great addition to the literature on decolonization. And a book on press reporting in Africa seems to me particularly apposite at this time, with established tropes of Africa as a sort of dark continent marshalled in the case against the Rwanda bill, and with apparently little attention paid to Rwanda's past or even recent history in ways that seem to correspond to what you've said about the reporting in the 50s and 60s. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Yeah, I obviously approach this from a very different angle. I'm not a historian of empire or the late 50s or the 60s. And I learned a huge amount from reading Rose's book, and I really enjoyed it. One of the things I really found it doing was actually both revealing certain biases that I have about British reporting, but also then challenging those biases. So I thought it'd be useful for me to actually reveal what those biases were. I'm an historian of the American media in World War II. In that period, of course, the American media is in working close cooperation and conflict with both British authorities and British reporters. And I think one of the things that really comes across from that 1940s period is actually how much more docile and biddable the British press is compared to the American press. There are lots of reasons for this. I think the political reason, the fact that American reporters are reared under First Amendment freedoms that frown upon formal control. The British often, and they still do in the 50s, operate in a more hostile environment. Libel laws, social scorn, D-notices sometimes being applied. There's also geography. The American media is much more decentralised and diffuse across the country. The 9 of the 10 newspapers that you focus on, Rosie, are based around here in Fleet Street. It's only just up the road to Westminster and Whitehall. And I think that creates sort of often a clubby environment, and where it's much easier for officials and MPs to sort of forge close relationships. And so I often get an impression of this sort of warm, fuzzy, quite relationship, which is entirely challenged by your book when you're looking at the British side of it. What I really was struck by was how the British press was relatively independent of the government. And as you put it, often frustrating the British government's efforts to impose its narrative on the politics of imperial endgame. I found that really fascinating. That was one of my big sort of takeaways. I won't go into the other aspects that you've talked about, which is the sort of the African side, and Sarah's much more expert on this than I am, but I'm gonna focus back on the British dimension of the story. And you obviously uncover a number of divisions within the British press. It's not homogenous by any stretch of the imagination. One of the obvious ones is party political, the division between left and right, the Mirror and the Herald on one side, the Mail and the Express on the other. And I think as I'm thinking about press coverage, as I'm thinking about news organisations, what I'm often thinking about is what is the function of a newspaper? What does a newspaper see itself as doing? That's quite a simple question, but the answer is complex, because news organisations are complicated affairs. There are different people with different functions at different parts of that process. And at the very top, where you've got the big press barons, some of the people have economic interests in the region. They do have clear biases that they are trying sometimes to push their newspapers to pursue each day. And of course, in the editorial room, where people are charged with op-ed pieces or column pieces, the whole purpose is to push a partisan position in order to try and change either government policy or opinion either in the region or inside Britain. But there are other parts of a news organisation that tend to operate on different assumptions. And I think this is something that's often underplayed in the literature. I think often the job of a newspaper is quite reactive. They're reacting to what's unfolding. They're focusing on what is deemed to be news. Now, I don't want to go into that in too much detail, but I think what you show in the late 50s and early 60s is that there were at least three occasions when the British press, regardless of its divisions, regardless of its partisan stripe, viewed the African decolonisation story as news. There are the independent ceremonies, which sometimes attract, I think, 600 correspondents were one of them. Huge numbers of foreign correspondents, not just British, but also from elsewhere. There were the moments when the British government itself thrust Africa onto the agenda, obviously with the Macmillan visit, but also with the different commissions, the Monckton commissions that he points out. And of course, there are the episodes of violence, the Mau Mau Rebellion and the Sharpsville Massacre, which you go into really good detail on. The episodes of violence do often hit the front pages, but they're often also the more difficult to report because, as you point out, that's where government control tends to be, censorship tends to come in. And you do a really excellent job of showing how these stories were reported, and you put quite a lot of those stories up there, and I think you partly have answered some of my next point here with some of those slides. But what I was left wondering, and I think a useful way of thinking about news reporting, is how editors deal with the stories they come in each day. An editor's job is to basically assemble a newspaper and make choices about what's going to go on the front page, what's going to get buried inside. And that's often based on the very fundamental assumption, what sells? Editors are, at the end of the day, interested in the bottom line. They don't want to lose readers. They want to keep their newspapers at the very best, or the very least, solvent. And so they're always thinking about, does a story sell? Is it big enough for the front page? Should it be buried inside? What should they actually do with it? And as I was reading it, I was quite interested, famously, the way editors always looking for a good murder story to pop on front page one, or a political, or these days a celebrity scandal. But also, of course, this is a period where there's a lot unfolding in the Cold War. How does decolonisation rate in the British press compared to the other crowded news agenda each day? And as you point out, there are many general books on British history that insist the public knew little and cared less about Africa. Were editors making that same calculation? I think you pointed out some of your slides. The Daily Mirror clearly didn't make that calculation. The Daily Mirror was often putting the Africa story on page one with big, vivid pictures. But how do editors rate the story? And does this press coverage itself, exactly where it's situated within a newspaper, does it help mute the impact of decolonisation, which is one of those themes of your book? Now, the way editors give to a story is often dependent on who writes them. Any point to some of these authors? Is it the big-name correspondents drawing hefty salaries, or the lowly stringers who sometimes don't even get a byline? When it comes to the independent celebrations or Macmillan's trip, I think what came from your book was that many of these British reporters resembled clueless tourists. They're travelling to the continent sometimes for their first visit. They know next to nothing about it, and they're therefore essentially writing, as you put it, a preordained story inspired by similar events in the past. And here is another bias that, when I'm thinking about as a non-expert about British reporting of Africa, my mind immediately went back to Evelyn Waugh's classic novel published in 1937, Scoop. Now, in that book, which contains quite a lot of controversial, of course, but Evelyn Waugh was, as you put it, joyfully studying the eccentricities and excesses of the correspondents covering the Ethiopian War in the 1930s, who spent the bulk of their time a long way from the action. And they were writing stories based on misleading briefings by local propaganda chiefs, or even actual inventions that bolstered the prejudices of their editors back home. Now, there's a lot to unpack in Waugh's novel, which of course is a satire, but it was based on his own experiences. And I think one of the things that comes through, and one of the ways in which Waugh's book had an impact in the 30s and the 40s, was this issue of reliability. Actually, are foreign correspondents really reporting the truth? This horrible modern term, fake news, which it goes way beyond some of the things we talked about today. Now, back in the 1930s, there was a New York Times reporter who also worked in Ethiopia, who also agreed that there were many fakers in the press corps, actually literally making up the story, not going anywhere there, but actually making up the story. Now, 20 years later, in the late 50s, and you point out, and I think it's one of the real strengths of your book, there were numerous limitations afflicting British reporting. Talked about some of them: the lack of knowledge, the ignorance of history, the reliance on familiar tropes, the omission of awkward facts. But your conclusion is actually nowhere near as damning as some of the commentary about reporting 20 years earlier. And also, I got a sense as well here, and I might be wrong here, you're not necessarily suggesting that contemporaries believed that British reporting was basically unreliable. You point out in South Africa in 1960, British newspapers would just sell out. And that left me, I suppose, thinking about why is there this reaction? Why is there this demand? Do readers, both in Britain and also in Africa, think that in some respects, despite all its limitations, the British press was a trusted source or not? Another implication of Evelyn Waugh's great novel, Scoop, is that, as you would argue, the British press, and I think a lot of a lot of memoirists would also, I think, point to this, is populated by what might be termed colourful characters. There's the autocratic, if eccentric, press barons, in Waugh's case, based on Lord Greenbrook. There's also the competitive, often hapless hacks on the ground. And you talk about many of these figures you've got in the 1950s, the press barons, not just Beaverbrook, but David Astor, the press corps, the number that you've interviewed, there's Ian Colvin of the Daily Telegraph who comes up, and also what you term the highly opinionated and contentious press pack that went with Macmillan to Africa in 1960. But I think my final impression, what I came away with here, was that these individual reporters or even the individual press barons were far less important in shaping the story than the context within which they were operating. The political leanings of their newspapers, the resources made available to cover the story, where those resources were deployed, and what you term the established patterns of investigation and reporting, which pointed to particular sets of sources and interpretations. Now, as historians, and I've worked quite a bit on, say, decision-making, historians of decision-making often talk about agency and structure, the role the individual plays. If you transpose that same debate to the world of the press, where does the balance lie? In your book, I really got a sense that you have come down more firmly on the side of structure. Individuals, even these colourful correspondents who are often writing memoir accounts, those who are attracted, this is still a golden age of reporting to Fleet Street, they are relatively unimportant compared to these other structural constraints. And so I suppose the final point, which is quite a big point here, is you can say a little bit more about the role of individuals. And I suppose also another way that historians often deal with the press is they write either biography or collective biography. And I think one of the takeaways I got from your great book, Rosie, is that actually this is not the best way of approaching it. Biography is very limited because reporters or even press barons don't actually have as much say on what appears each day in the press because of all these other structural constraints. So perhaps if you could say a little bit more about the role of biography in the historiography of the fall of this state. And I'll leave it. Thank you very much for a great meeting.
Rosie, there's quite a few questions. Do you want to respond to at least some of them before I collect some questions from the audience?
Yes, I will. That's from my notes here as well. Thank you so much, both of you, for... Yes, sorry, can you see one another?
Hi. Who might be first? Should we just move on?
Yeah,
should
we move around to the front?
Rosie, do you want to sit down there and I'll move the chair?
There's that chair.
There we go. It's a lovely room, but it's a hard one to navigate. There we are.
Sorry, I will have my back.
You sit in the middle. You sit in the middle.
Yeah, there we go. Sorry. thank you both very much. I have the answer to lots of questions. I might not be able to answer all of them. So starting with Sarah's points, I think. This characterization of the press as throwing a transnational web of influence over the decolonization process. I imagine that as, I think I've thought of it in quite a visual way, in the sense that like a spider web, it sort of connected people in different places, whilst at the same time in shaping the narratives that traveled along the parts of the web. So that's how I sort of imagined it.
I didn't imagine the press as being, you know, the people that were controlling what was happening on the web, but that they, the web itself provided an provided, I think I'd say, vectors of opportunity in changing times. So nationalists in like Nyasaland might try to influence British policy via British public opinion through the press, and then that in turn would impact the way in which British politicians responded to events in Africa. So I sort of imagined it as a kind of quite a fluid construct, I suppose, in which the press definitely had an influence, but that was very much affected by the groups that were interacting with the press, whether they be in Africa or in Britain. I am not sure about the issue of the way in which other sectors of, you know, other presses covered covered Africa at this time, except from reading secondary source material. It's something that I should look at.
Well, I realise it probably lies beyond the scope of your book, but you know, you whetted my appetite to know more about some of those aspects. So, yeah, it's probably another project, isn't it?
I think so, although I have seen a lot more work being done on this now. So, yes, very important to compare that. And also in terms of the other kinds of media as well. You know, television in Britain and how these narratives might be different. Sorry, I can't read my writing. the gendered nature of British press reporting is a very interesting question, I think. And as I said, I only came across one woman. Her name was Anne Sharpley, and she reported, I think it was for the Evening Standard, during the Prime Minister's tour of Africa. I get the feeling from some kind of evidence I looked at, she was a bit kind of, I didn't have enough evidence to make any firm conclusions about her, if I'm honest, but she seemed quite hard-nosed and probably found it a little bit challenging being in a kind of very, very male-dominated space. Actually, I think she wrote one of the kind of, when she covered the incidents of colonial brutality in Nyasaland during the tour, she produced one of the more kind of critical narratives from the point of view of criticizing the activists, actually, as opposed to the police. In terms of whether African women's, you know, activists were represented in the press, yes, definitely, they were. I have pictures, actually, I didn't bring it today, but pictures from the ones I projected at the start. There were pictures of what happened during that demonstration in Blantyre that involved women protesters really being at the forefront of the demonstration. And actually, they were the ones that were affected by the police brutality / heavy-handedness. It was very opaque what happened during that event. And also during the Prime Minister's time in South Africa as well. I think at that point it was mostly related to the fact that it was understood that perhaps the police would be less sort of heavy-handed in response to women protesters than they would be in response to men. And so during the tour, when there were lots of eyes on what was happening, I think the ANC, I think I'm right in saying the ANC put forward women protesters, and they were absolutely part of the discussion in the press. Mm. Yeah, but in general, not so much.
Yes.
It's really interesting questions here. I For this question about what the function of a newspaper is, well, it's tricky, isn't it? I was thinking. I feel like the function, from what I looked at, the function of a newspaper is, I can't really say that it is to do anything, but it is the function is that it sort of embodies and transmits and sometimes transforms cultural beliefs, societal beliefs. I feel that that's what comes through. That's what comes through most clearly in these, you know, in these different case studies, the former part of the book. I feel I see very much the kind of historical roots of the imagery and the language and the ways of thinking about things coming through. And I feel that, yeah, a newspaper really embodies and transmits and transforms those sentiments, really, I would say. The question of where the coverage was situated within the newspaper mute the impact of decolonization, you know, if it was, say, in the middle of the page or something. I feel like all these stories were given front page coverage in the vast majority of papers. I would say that, I mean, it is, I guess, one argument that I have seen in relation to why it is that perhaps British people today don't know so much about what went on in their name overseas during the British Empire, including in respect of a lot of colonial brutality, colonial violence, is that it was sort of covered up. I get the feeling that it wasn't so much, I think what's more important is not that it was covered up, but the way in which it was discussed was far more significant. So the brutality was absolutely a part of these narratives, but the way in which they were discussed, I think, would have helped British readers, or those that I guess were sympathetic in this way, to kind of negotiate decolonization in optimistic ways. So I would say, yeah, not really whether it was there or not, or where and when the paper it was, but just kind of the way in which it's presented was more impactful in relation to muting these kind of difficult feelings. Do readers think that the British press is a trusted source or not? It's a tricky one. Wow, I've come to talk about the 3 years. Yeah, I think, in the case of South Africa, I would probably say that because of censorship within South Africa at this time, people were kind of grasping for anything that was not censored, and that perhaps British newspapers offered one of the best options. But in Ghana, the British press was discussed because it was considered an untrusted source. The CBP was concerned about confronting and really challenging the narratives that were present on the basis that they were not telling the correct story about what was happening in Ghana. So I think there were a number of motives in relation to why people engage with the press at this time.
I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pause you there and then maybe collect a few comments and questions from the room, and you can maybe come back to some of the other points. But would you like to start us off?
Yeah, okay, thank you. Thank you very much. It was super interesting. I had a question. Obviously, a lot of press was given towards the decolonization process. It was all, you know, being on the global stage of, you know, the Cold War and the New World Order, and decolonization was very central, specifically African, and obviously there was a lot written about it. However, it didn't necessarily feature very high, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I know, it didn't necessarily feature very high as a topic of discussion at general elections, right? As in, I don't think
most people were sort of concerned about all sorts of other things that were governing their daily lives in the post-war era. So why do you think so much was gone about in terms of trying to change the narrative, put in the narrative, sort of make kind of, you touched on the point of it, trying to make Britain feel a little bit better about themselves and what the reality was, so on and so forth. But if at the ballot box, it wasn't really much of a point of contention, why do you think there's this huge dichotomy or between sort of trying to push it in the public arena, but the everyday sort of voter wasn't necessarily paying much attention to it or didn't really sort of care as much to it as a lot of the other things that were in the room?
Thank you very much. I'm going to collect another question, if that's okay, Rosie.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Rachel. I really look forward to reading your book, which is fascinating, with your complex presentation of structure and agency. This is a question, and you may not have looked at this. You emphasise very much the print press. And of course, this is not the sole press landscape in the particular period. I was just wondering whether you also had the opportunity of looking at the BBC external services, because this is very much the age of radio. Another platform for the presentation of a press view, a narrative, of course, was Pathé News. So I'm thinking of other, if you like, multimedia, in addition to the contested landscape that you present. So thank you very much.
Do you want to answer those two, and then I'll come back to
Yes. I think I'll answer the first question first, because I haven't looked at those sources. Yes, perhaps that's my next project or a next project, because I haven't looked at those. In this, the other question about British elections, and I couldn't hear everything on the microphone very well, but I think the question was about, if I understand it correctly, why I put forward this argument about the press being impactful in relation to the way in which people in Britain thought about the end of empire.
And also why the press went through such lengths of trying to sort of spin a narrative to the public opinion when it wasn't really a matter that weighed that much in terms of how they voted. I mean, I guess it's just more sort of, if you had any thoughts around that.
There was an election in 1959, and there was a lot of effort, by the British government in that during that year, certainly to kind of dampen negative coverage of the Hola massacre and the Nyasaland state of emergency. In a sense, I think the government was very concerned about newspaper coverage of those events. They quite successfully kind of allayed people's concerns, I suppose. Okay. I think a bit more about
maybe they were so successful, that's why I didn't enter the other questions? Yes, Anna.
So you mentioned that you interviewed journalists or editors. Could you tell us a bit about that experience of interviewing them, and perhaps picking up on Steve's point about sort of biography and the way that journalists might curate the history of their own actions? Did you come up against any kind of tensions around what they wanted to talk about or how they saw their actions in the past?
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
I was wondering if you could say anything about how the public interacted with newspapers. So is there any evidence of the public sort of talking to one another about what was in the newspapers? How were the newspapers read? Was it a sort of communal thing or an individual thing, either in Britain or Africa, if you know anything about that?
On the question of interviewing, yes, I met three of them. And one I corresponded with. It was originally meant to be an interview, but it turned into correspondence. One thing I can say is that journalists are amazing to work with. They respond so quickly, and they always say yes to everything. I guess they're used to, well, at least the people that I spoke to, such kind people inviting me into their home, and yes, it was wonderful. I would say, very open, I would say, despite the fact that they were covering events that, you know, were, difficult, to put it mildly, really. There were some challenges, I think, in relation to memory, because this was the 1950s, and that did affect the amount I was able to use in the book. Generally, I mean, they answered my questions very, very clearly and very, very helpfully, and were brilliant. On the subject of biography, which Steve also raised, I think it's so important. I guess, I didn't do it, you know, but I think this is, would be a very, very important further line of inquiry. This question that Steve, you were asking me about in relation to agency and structure, I think, I would say that, I wasn't thinking so much when writing the book in terms of agency and structure, I would say. I was thinking more in terms of short and long-term causes which lay behind the production of coverage. But I would say that, my opinion from this research is that agents, you know, shape structures, and that when other agents come along and have different opinions, you know, that conflict with what's integral to the structure, I would say that it just takes a bit of time and perhaps multiple voices and repeated efforts for those structures to change. So it's not that journalists don't have an impact as individuals, and there were moments where they absolutely did. But then you see, when you look at the coverage as it progresses, the narratives just revert to the older ones that reflect, I think, those more historical roots. But that over time, if there are enough voices and there are enough kind of efforts made, change does occur. And I was thinking in relation to the more agentic kind of feature of the coverage, which focused on African nationalism and the importance of African nationalism, that, you know, was sort of, you could say that lay kind of in tension with the kind of broader sweep of British press coverage over many decades, but that itself had taken years to form, and had, you know, been the outcome of a number of politicians and activists and pressmen in both Britain and Africa. So I think that's the way that I see it, I would say, and I would think if you wrote a biography about a journalist, there would be a lot to say about the context within which they operated anyway, I would think.
And Pip's question about readership.
Yes.
And how people are absorbing these stories, whether individually or in...
Yeah, this is a really tricky one, I must say. I mean, this was the hardest part of my research, particularly, so in Africa, I looked at documentary evidence, archival evidence, to try to determine how people understood the newspaper coverage. A lot of that was held in, say, government archives or personal papers of politicians who wrote what they said that they thought about British newspaper coverage. So I could kind of, but these were prominent people in society. This was not sort of the average person on the street. In Britain, when I think about British public attitudes towards Africa, decolonization, it's really tricky. I don't have any evidence for that. So the way in which I tackled it was to look at, just to draw some conclusions from critical discourse analysis,
to try to identify which aspects of text were more likely to have been internalized by readers. And that related to both things that were very prominent and then also to some of the more subtle underlying kind of assumptions that were present in papers and that weren't sort of articulated, but that were there in newspapers across the entire political spectrum, and that may well be more reflective of kind of cultural assumptions and attitudes than opinions that are kind of expressed in a very explicit way. So that's the way that I dealt with that. But yeah.
Okay, I think we've got time for one final round of questions. I've got quite a few hands up actually, so we'll take a few. And Anthony, do you want to? Then I'll go.
Well, I mean, I have a, in regard to that last question, mass observation may have some answers. Mm-hmm. University of Sussex is the place to go. But I wanted to ask about this reflection on the process of decolonization that you were referring to. I mean, surely there is, from the British identity, a sense that there is a future, and the future is good, because after all, what have we done? We've given them the rule of law. We've given them the mother of parliaments to base themselves on. And it, I was wondering the degree to which there is actually a sense that the future is optimistic, not just for Britain, but for the newly independent countries, because of this benevolent legacy that we've left behind. And whether actually there is even difference in the, from different political viewpoints on that, whether maybe the right wing are less inclined to think well of Africans taking this forward, and perhaps David Astor sort of saying, no, 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 this is going to be wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just wanted to ask whether you had come in contact with the reports on internal movements from Britain, like protests, if there were any, in from 1957 to 1960, and how were these reported in the national press?
And was there a question right at the back?
Yeah. Am I right in thinking that the basically the British press, particularly through editorials, were broadly supportive of decolonisation? And if so, is that in part due to the experiences of a few years before, for instance, the French in Vietnam and us and the French in Suez, where if you don't let things go voluntarily, it can get extremely nasty?
Okay, I think there's...
Sorry.
was a reflection on kind of the benevolence of empire.
Self-satisfaction.
Yeah. I think... I think I definitely think that this was a sentiment that cut across so many British newspapers. When I talk about in the book the kind of absence of history in British newspaper reports, what I'm referring to is the difficult side of it. But certainly there is the presence of a sort of rose-tinted view of the past that comes through very clearly, and that provides a foundation, I think, for a lot of this. Definitely.
And was there different? I think the other question was between right and left, or did you?
Is there any difference on there between maybe the Tory graph and the Observer?
I think the right leaning press was just more strident in saying it. I would say that the same sorts of understandings about Britain's colonial past that were kind of, or misunderstandings about British colonial past that were kind of not negative,
were present across the press. And that owed to, well, a number of factors, I think. But I think some of them related to just thinking about the history of, well, the history of British imperialism and, you know, who were the dominant voices, the dominant groups. You know, when did the press come along, and how, who did they connect with? And I feel that, yeah, that was a reflection of the way the press grew and the way the empire was, and that, yeah, I guess the press sort of internalized. The question about internal protest in Britain, that was definitely covered. I think, for example, in relation to apartheid, so following the Sharpeville massacre, for example, protest outside South Africa House, just down the road, was definitely covered. And other sorts of protests that related to, I guess, issues that connected. I mean, it was a time of great social change, and there were discussions in Britain about related matters, such as regarding race and racism in Britain too. And there were protests surrounding those issues in Britain that were covered and that were connected in editorials sometimes to what was happening in this question is really interesting, and I think it cuts to the heart of the kind of the main theme, really. If I remember this correctly, was the British press broadly supportive of decolonization?
Yeah.
I did think a lot about which words to use. I wouldn't say supportive in all cases. But yes, I think what I've tried to say is that in some cases, definitely supportive, if not actually advocating for it, in the case of a paper like The Observer. In other newspapers, I think it was more, I got a sense that the press was just understood nationalism to be such a powerful force that it would inevitably win, that it would inevitably happen, that countries would become independent in Africa. So I think, yeah, there was a big recognition of the inevitability of decolonization. Why that was, I haven't studied other events such as Vietnam and Suez, and that may well have fed into this. From the evidence I looked at, the reason that this conclusion, I think, was so prominent was because British journalists were impacted by the efforts of African nationalists, really, very much so. Nationalism was such a massive force, and journalists recognized that and wrote about it. And often made friendships as well with nationalists too.
Okay, well, I think we've reached the end of our time, and I just wanted to say thank you so much both to Rosie and also to Sarah and Steve for commenting on the book. Thank you all for coming, and I believe outside we have some drinks and reception very kindly has provided by the Modern World History Cluster in the Department of International History, but please join us outside for a reception afterwards. And before that, please join me in thanking Rosie once again. Available on Amazon. An all good bookshop.
I think. I'm embarrassed to bring it last. 20% discount.